A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. I'm going to be talking with Cody Wisniewski of the Firearms Policy Coalition about Vanderstock v. Garland. This is the case dealing with the ATF's rule on unfinished frames and receivers. The Supreme Court granting the government's request to hear this case on Monday. Oral arguments will likely be held in the fall. And then we'll get a decision at some point, probably before the end of the year, as to whether or not the ATF's rule can continue to be enforced. Now, you'll remember a district court judge found that the ATF had exceeded its authority when adopting this rule. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed, but in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court allowed the ATF rule to continue to be enforced while the legal challenge continues. Is that a bad sign? When Vanderstock actually goes before the high court? Well, we'll start our conversation with Cody Wisniewski there, but a much lengthier discussion follows. Take a look and a listen. Cody, thanks so much for joining me on the program. It's good to see you again.
Of course, sir. Glad to be here again.
And congratulations. We call this SCOTUS Moss? What Vanderstock Moss? I'm not sure what we call this, but I know that you are excited that the Supreme Court has granted cert in the Vanderstock case, even though this request was from DOJ, right? Because they're the ones who lost at the district court level and at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So they're the ones that had to request Supreme Court review. But ultimately, this was the goal all along, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. The important thing here. You know, we were victorious at the district court. We were victorious at the Fifth Circuit. But the thing is, you know, having the Supreme Court be able to review this question, weigh in on this question, is almost an inevitability when you've got a federal court striking down an executive branch agency, you know, final rule like it did. So it was almost an inevitability anyway. And plus, then it gives us the opportunity to make this case in front of the Supreme Court to get a truly, you know, full and final decision that is very obviously completely impactful across the nation and is, you know, completely effective against that final rule.
How concerned are you that the court agreed to let this rule be enforced while the case is being litigated? Does that concern you at all?
No, not at all. And you know, I even think we talked about this before. The court can be pretty deferential when it comes to government actors. And so the fact that it was the, you know, the government going up on an emergency basis, asking for kind of a stay of the injunction that we had, it doesn't really concern me. I don't think it really has any bearings on what the court will finally decide on the merits of the case. And I don't really think it matters when it comes to their review of, you know, the filings that we're going to put before them.
Sure. Okay. Next question. Is this a Second Amendment case? Is this a case of administrative abuse or both? Yeah, what are you going to be arguing before the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think the easiest way is to say this is a gun rights case. This is not a pure Second Amendment claim in this case. Specifically, it is a case that's brought under the Administrative Procedure Act. Now you can bring constitutional claims under the Administrative Procedure Act, and we have in this case. But really, at its base, this is a question of agency power, because what the ATF did here was just completely expand its own authority by rereading federal law, right? So Congress passed the law and set the language as it did. And ATF basically is attempting to reinterpret that language so that it could regulate significantly more things than it could regulate before and that Congress ever intended it to regulate. So at its base, it is what we call an APA case, an administrative law case. And it really is a pure question of statutory interpretation, of interpretation of the definition of firearm under the Gun Control Act. And that's going to be the predominant argument that you're going to see in the case.
And as defined under the Gun Control Act, a firearm is defined as a frame or receiver, right? Not something that could be turned into a frame or a receiver. Is that the heart of the case here? The government says, well, this can include things that may one day become something that's defined as a firearm under federal law. So we should go ahead and be able to treat it as a firearm right now.
That's basically their argument. Yeah. So the Gun Control Act has a 4-subpart definition of firearm. The first two are what's really relevant to this case. The first is, you know, a weapon that is designed or can be readily converted into a or a weapon that fires in a projectile by means of an explosion. So that's explosion. That's subsection A. And then subsection B is the frame or receiver of such weapon. Now, what the ATF tried to do in regulating these things that, you know, we in the industry call like 80% frames or 80% receivers, of course, that means nothing. It's just a convenient moniker.
Sure.
What the ATF is trying to do is read that readily converted language from the first subsection, sub A, into subsection B to say that, oh, well, we're also going to regulate these items that are readily converted into frames or receivers. The problem is, if, you know, there's a basic principle of statutory interpretation. When Congress or a lawmaking body uses words in one section and doesn't use them in later sections, then you have to assume that it didn't intend or didn't want that language to apply in later sections. Congress knew how to regulate items that could be readily converted. They did in subsection A, but they chose not to apply that language to frames or receivers. And so ATF can't go back and read in language that isn't there. And that's essentially what it's trying to do.
And, you know, it's interesting because the ATF is not only being sued by FPC and SAF over the frame and receiver rule, but the gun control groups are suing ATF over the same rule too, right? They're alleging that the ATF is misreading its own rule and is not going far enough, right? Because the ATF, after it passed this absurd rule, said, okay, well, we're really only going to apply it to the buy, build, shoot kits, right? If you just get an incomplete frame or receiver, there are no tools that come with it. Well, okay, that's not readily converted. Now, again, I don't understand what the distinction is, but the gun control group said, well, that doesn't go far enough. We want you to go after every unfinished frame or receiver, which to me speaks to the vagueness of the ATF's new rule, right? I mean, if even the gun control groups are saying, well, this doesn't, you're not using the rule to the fullest extent you can, and our side saying, well, you don't have the authority to impose this rule at all, it seems like there's an issue here with the rule itself.
Yeah, this one really presents an interesting kind of unique legal landscape, and so in effect, there's really only two cases. So there's our Vanderstock case, in which, you know, several other parties kind of intervened along the way in the case. And so now there's, you know, there's a number of parties, but we initially filed with two individuals on behalf of FPC and then on behalf of a producer of these items, Tactical Machining. There's another case in California that was filed by these gun control groups in California. And that's the one you're referring to, in which they're saying, you know, the rule doesn't go far enough. And there, a federal district court judge actually ruled that part of the rule may not have gone far enough and required that portion to be remanded back to the agency for additional consideration. What's clear is that this case being before the Supreme Court, again, why this is so important, is the Supreme Court will have the final say on this. I mean, there's no question that whatever the Supreme Court says will bind, you know, the rest of the lower courts across the country. So it's another important reason for this case, you know, moving quickly and getting before SCOTUS, is that it will give us the opportunity to have the final say on this rule. And it's so obvious a matter of statutory interpretation that it's just clear that the ATF can't do what it's doing. In fact, what's interesting is in those cases, there was an older case as well that was actually dismissed, that was filed in New York by gun control groups and by several cities. In those cases, ATF initially defended its position because those cases were actually filed before the rule was published. They were filed at the tail end of the Trump administration.
Okay.
And they were filed to force the ATF to engage in a rulemaking. And then when the Biden administration came into office and eventually issued the rulemaking, they changed those lawsuits to say, oh, we know you did the rulemaking that we said we wanted you to do, but by the way, it doesn't go as far as we think it should. And so it actually shifted the character of what those cases were. But when the Department of Justice and ATF were defending their position initially, they used a lot of language that, you know, we've cited in our case that shows that they completely reversed positions with this rule, that they used to interpret it correctly, that they used to interpret it the way that, you know, it has to be interpreted the way that we advance that it should be interpreted and applied. And so they actually kind of sunk their own ship in those cases somewhat, where they basically said, yeah, these are two separate subsections. We can't apply language from one subsection to another. Now they've tried, kind of changed their tune, but it was really telling in those early days before even the rule was out that, you know, it was interpreted in this way, and that it has to be, because there can be only this single application of the law.
And until this new rule came out, that has been the sole interpretation of the ATF from the time that the GCA was passed, right? I mean, this was the one interpretation. Then the Biden administration comes in and all of a sudden, oh, now we read the law differently.
Yeah, for decades, right? I mean, these things haven't been in some sort of weird legal limbo for decades. For ATF has constantly issued guidance under the GCA that these items are not firearms. In fact, you know, that's how the producers of these things exist. That's where the industry was based on, is they all have guidance letters from the ATF for going back decades saying that none of these things meet the federal definition, that they're not firearms, that they can't be regulated as if they're firearms. I mean, it was never even really a question. And it wasn't until the administration chose to pursue this path, because it can't pass a law in Congress, right? That's the dirty secret here, right? Is if they could actually pass a law through Congress that would amend the GCA, then they could attempt to do this that route, right? That would then bring up Second Amendment questions on whether that law was constitutional. Mm-hmm. But it's not the purview of executive branch agencies to rewrite federal law. That's not what they're supposed to be doing. That's not what they're allowed to be doing. And what this was, it was an attempt to end run Congress. They didn't have the votes. They couldn't get a bill passed. And so instead, they issued this rule reinterpreting federal law, trying to allow them to regulate these things because they don't like them. And they get into this backwards analysis of, you know, oh, well, these things are, you know, not regulated. This is an underlying right. You have the right to craft your own self-defense tools. And the fact that it has not been regulated for 250 years is because, at least regulated in this manner for 250 years, is because that right is inherent and belongs to the people. It's not because it's something that the government can divvy or dole out on a whim. It's something that's ours, and they don't have the ability to regulate in the main means that they're trying to do.
Do you get the sense, Cody, that the government's argument is going to be both technical and I think primarily emotional? I mean, I get that sense that, you know, they're going to argue, look, we're seeing more of these ghost guns show up at crime scenes. Law enforcement says, you know, they're showing up everywhere. You can, you know, build a gun without having to go through a background check. We need this law in place to stop violent crime. So even if, you know, even if Congress should have done this, I mean, not that they go this far, but, you know, sort of the implication would be that even if this is Congress's role, this rule is needed for public safety. So you got to let us have it.
I think that's exactly right. That's exactly what they're going to argue. And what's interesting is, even taking on that point, right? I don't care if these items were the predominant thing showing up at crime scenes, it still wouldn't undermine the fact that it's our right to be able to self-manufacture our own firearms, right? We're talking about something that's a natural, inherent, fundamental right. Even taking on that point, it's not true. I mean, the ATF couldn't even point to specific statistics about recovery of these items at crime scenes. I mean, it was a minuscule number that they were recovering and that they're trying to lay blame on. The fact of the matter is, you know, we know that people who want to do bad things with firearms are going to find ways to acquire firearms. And the truth of the matter is, as of right now, they're certainly not doing that using the self-manufacturing method. They're buying illegal guns on the streets. I mean, that's just what the data shows.
Yeah. But
well and beyond that, this isn't the ATF's power. It's not within its purview. And so I do think that they're going to make the emotional appeal. I do think that they're going to try and make this situation sound incredibly scary. And the key will be ensuring that the justices can see beyond that and can see that, one, simply not true, and two, that even if it were true, it isn't within the purview of the ATF to do what it's doing. If Congress wants to act, Congress can act, and then we can have a Second Amendment conversation. But the ATF certainly does not have the authority to issue this rule and certainly does not have the authority to regulate these items.
All right. So let's talk timing here. Supreme Court made its announcement yesterday. Oral arguments, they're going to be held in the fall.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So they'll be probably towards the start of next term, October, November, most likely. And then the briefing will, undergo over the summer
Sure.
while the court is in recess.
Okay. Do we expect a decision by the end of the year?
It's really hard to say on these ones. So, there's always court watchers will always tell you, they save the big decisions for right when they're about to go into recess,
Right.
in June. It's a little bit more uncommon to have something that's argued in October or November make it all the way to June, just because that's such a long time for the court to be sitting on it.
Yeah.
It's very possible that there's a decision by the end of December. It's also possible that it comes in the spring, and there's also a possibility of June. So the real answer is it's just there's no way of saying, and there's nothing that binds the court to issue a decision by a specific point other
Yeah.
than they, in practice, will obviously issue all their decisions before they go into recess.
All right. I'm going to ask you another question that involves mindless speculation here. Maybe semi-mindful speculation. Costas Moros said something on X yesterday about he was excited to see the Supreme Court do this, but gosh, the Supreme Court keeps taking all of these requests from the government, right? The Rahimi case, bump stock ban, now of Vanderstock. He says, it'd be nice if they'd take one of our requests too. Do you think that this is, does it make it more or less likely, or does it really matter that the Supreme Court has granted cert here when we've got these, pending requests for cert in Antonyuk, in Bianchi, and I think the Seventh Circuit cases, right? The Illinois PICA cases as well.
Yeah, so it doesn't no, it doesn't concern me.
Okay.
So anybody who's watched the court for the past however long, it is really it's just much more common that the court is going to hear requests from the government than it is that it's going to hear requests from the people. The other side of that coin too is the government is having to request cert in Second Amendment cases. So what that means is we're winning below, right?
Right.
For 14 years under, basically under the flawed application of Heller, you could count victories on a hand and maybe on two. There just weren't those victories below. So, we were always petitioning, and of course the court wasn't taking requests, which was its own problem. The fact that the court has had to, or sorry, the fact that the federal government has had to request cert in several cases just shows that we're winning below. And so I think that there's a, there's an interesting other kind of data point on the other side of that, of how these cases are coming up. And then on, Bianchi and Harrell's that Seventh Circuit case that we've got a petition up at the Supreme Court also. There's several cases, all rising out of Illinois. But those are actually just set to finish briefing this month. So the final reply briefs will be filed in both of those cases, this month. And then they'll be circulated for conference. So the Supreme Court still has the opportunity to grant cert in either of those cases. They're not, they've still got plenty of calendar left for next term. They've still got plenty of space. So we're still really hopeful that they're going to grant cert in one or both of those cases. Maybe it could hear them together. But there's still plenty of opportunity for them to grant a petition from a plaintiff's side of you as opposed to the federal government as a defendant. But I look at that and I go, one, it's common for the court to grant or the court to grant requests from the government. Two, I am thrilled that the government is having to file cert petitions because that means we're winning in the circuit courts.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I know we're going to be talking plenty before the oral arguments take place, but again, congratulations. I am excited here to see the oral arguments, not necessarily the government side of things, but I'm delighted that y'all are going to have the opportunity to challenge this ATF rule in the highest court of the land. And, as you pointed out on X as well, it really is remarkable how quickly this case has moved, right? I mean, you talk about, some of these public interest lawsuits taking a decade. I think you said you've got an FPC case that's been kicking around for 7 years now. So the fact that this is going up to the Supreme Court in a little more than 2 years really is extraordinary. How do the wheels get greased in this case?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of factors, right? So that's what's really important when you're talking about, strategic litigation. There's a lot of factors that go into it and how arguments are crafted, what arguments are advanced, how things are put before the court. I know that a lot of times people like to speculate on socials, and of course, we can't ever discuss legal strategy, nor would we publicly, right? I mean, we're certainly not going to show our hand to the federal government. So there are always a lot of factors that go into being, you know, really strategic about how these cases are presented to the court, what arguments are made, what arguments are advanced. One big thing here, honestly, was that we just refused to be slowed down as the case proceeded. Like I said, this one was unique in that this isn't like pistol braces where there's six or seven different cases, right? There's just the one. And over the course of the first few months, you know, Black Hawk Manufacturing Group, 80% Arms, filed a motion to intervene and intervened in the lawsuit. SAF intervened along with Defense Distributed. Polymer 80 eventually moved to intervene. So this is one case that everybody kind of joined into along the course of the case after we filed it. And that was also unique too, because it means that there's just kind of one case kind of speeding along the tracks, moving up into the courts. And so it was a very different posture than, you know, all of these different courts discussing what the other courts are doing and responding to what the other courts are doing. This is one case in front of one judge, or, you know, at the Fifth Circuit, of course, in front of a panel of three. So it was very unique in that perspective. And one of the things that we were really, really key on was just working as hard as possible. So oftentimes when you have a case that, let's say you get a preliminary injunction and it gets appealed up to the circuit, a lot of times you'll pause what's going on at the district court, the merits, to just deal with the preliminary injunction and move that up. Mm-hmm. We didn't do that. We simultaneously litigated at both the Fifth Circuit and at the district court, just to ensure that we were getting a decision as quickly as possible. So while the government was appealing our injunction, because we got an injunction in from the district court, while the federal government was appealing our injunction to the Fifth Circuit, we fully briefed the case and got a decision on the merits of the case before the Fifth Circuit even heard argument on the government's preliminary injunction appeal. So we refused to be slowed down, because that's the thing, right? Government, and you know, one of the other things I kind of mentioned on X, you know, formerly Twitter, was that government will, you know, magically all these issues will come up in a public interest case when the government thinks it's going to lose, that somehow slow the case down, you know, miraculously.
Right.
They might question standing. They might want to stay this. They might want extensions on this. They might want this court to wait and consider what this other court is deciding, right? You see that a lot in the Ninth Circuit. A lot of cases are getting stayed because of other cases.
Yep.
And they just will pull out all these tactics. And one of the things we did here was we just refused. I mean, there's too much at stake in these cases. There was too much at stake in this litigation. And, you know, while we try and kind of keep the foot on the gas pedal in all of our cases, you know, that's something that, you know, FPC and FPC Action Foundation really focus on is driving these cases. Sometimes we're not able to, because, you know, you're at the whims of the court and the judges get to decide the schedule. But here, you know, we were able to do so and really push it forward and get it to the Supreme Court as quickly as possible.
Well, I'm glad that you did, because, again, this is an important question and it should be resolved in gun owners' favor, obviously. And hopefully we get to see that here in the months ahead. Cody, listen, as always, man, I appreciate you joining us on the program. If folks, you know, want to help those FPC lawsuit printers go brr, how do they do so?
Yeah, so they can find us at firearmspolicy.org. You know, of course, you can join FPC at that website. You can follow all the work at Gun Policy or at FPC Action for FPC Action Foundation. And just, you know, join and support. We do this just because it's so important. I think I even said it at one point, right? Like, the brunt of this rule is keeping people out of jail, keeping people out of prison, people being able to exercise their rights. And that's what matters at the end of the day. And so we're fighting for people to be able to live their lives. You know, the mission of the organization is fighting for a world of maximal human liberty. And that's really what this is about. So if people like our work, if they appreciate what we're doing, you know, they can go, like I said, firearmspolicy.org. Then go join FPC there, follow us on social media across all the different accounts.
Awesome. Cody, thanks so much for your time, man. I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Awesome. Thank you, Cam.
Thanks once again to Cody for joining me on the program today. Looking forward to having him back again in the very near future. Right now, let's turn our attention. Well, actually, before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for a second. At the very heart of our democracy lies a principle that we hold sacred, free speech. It's the cornerstone that supports every freedom we cherish. Yet in today's digital age, discussions about our wealth, our rights, and our future are being silenced or overshadowed in mainstream media, leaving many feeling voiceless in conversations that are crucial to our financial independence and security. That's where Wealth Protection Research steps in. Armed with a mission that's never been more critical, Wealth Protection Research is not a financial advisory firm. They're defenders of free speech, committed to giving a voice to the silenced. Wealth Protection Research tirelessly seeks out financial experts. And these are the voices that challenge prevailing narratives, especially as we navigate the uncertainties of the 2024 election. Wealth Protection Research has created a 2024 Election Wealth Protection Report. This free report highlights the three best ideas for protecting and growing your money heading into the 2024 election. It contains ideas the mainstream media won't touch. And listeners can get a copy completely free by texting IDEAS to 76626. If you believe in the sanctity of free speech and the importance of financial freedom, then act now. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy of this 2024 Election Protection Report. It's time to widen the scope of what we're told, to hear the ideas the establishment doesn't think you can handle, and to take control of our financial destinies. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. All right. In today's recidivist report, we've got a story out of Minnesota. And no, it does not involve the state senator who was arrested on burglary charges. No, because I think that might be her first arrest. At least I haven't seen any other arrests reported here. And to be fair, Raul Rios did not have a lengthy criminal history before he was arrested in relation to a drive-by shooting in 2023. And that is the reason why judge in this case sentenced young Mr. Rios to probation instead of jail time. In fact, his co-defendant in this drive-by shooting received the same sentence as well. Raul Rios sentenced to 5 years probation for his involvement in a drive-by shooting in Northeast Rochester, Minnesota last August. It originally started in the Bolo City parking lot before moving to the Northern Valley Drive, according to KALTV, where it is said that the shooting took place. Nobody was hurt, thankfully, but Rios was one of a couple of individuals who were originally facing felony charges. Rios charged with a felony charge of drive-by shooting towards a person. Back in February, he ended up pleading guilty to a reduced charge of aiding and abetting second-degree assault. LeBron Giwa, who was one of the other teens involved in the incident, also pleaded guilty to second-degree assault. He was given probation back in February. Rios, again, getting 5 years probation on Monday. Olmsted County Judge Lisa Hain said cases like this are tough because of the charges and Rios's young age. She says she didn't think prison would do him any good. She said that she was impressed by Rios's commitment to turning his life around since his arrest. He's gotten a full-time job. He was recently accepted into college, which is great. That's fantastic. And I hope that it sticks. At the same time, Mr. Rios and Giwa, both accused of a pretty serious crime, right? I mean, last time I checked, a drive-by shooting is a violent offense. And yet, the judge in this case going out of her way to ensure that this young offender doesn't do any time behind bars. Not even a, you know, shock probation sentence where you get maybe a few months in prison to sort of give you a taste of what a longer sentence would be like, and then you are released on probation. Nope, just straight 5 years. He could be resentenced to 36 months in prison if he violates his probation, but note the word could there, right? That rarely happens in these cases. So Raul Rios getting a sweetheart deal and avoiding jail time for his role in a drive-by shooting in Rochester, Minnesota last August. Today's Armed Citizen story from Surprise, Arizona, where a home intruder, actually two of them, got a surprise when they encountered an armed homeowner who shot one of the two suspects. According to police in the Arizona town, happened on April 22nd. Two suspects trying to break into a home. The resident inside, one of the residents anyway, opened fire, striking one of the suspects. When officers arrived at the scene, they were able to take both of the suspects into custody, one of whom hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries. The suspects' identities have not yet officially been released by police, but Fox 10 in Phoenix reports that the home invasion victim said that the suspects first rang his doorbell at 4 o'clock in the morning. Says he didn't answer, but they then came in through the back door and cornered him. Says he doesn't know who the men were, doesn't know if his roommates know who they were either. Which is why he acted the way he did. One neighbor named Justin said, you know, it's pretty shocking. This is a neighborhood where you can leave your cars unlocked. Nothing like that happens here. By the way, no, No, there really isn't a neighborhood where you, I mean, listen, you can leave your car unlocked in every neighborhood, but I would argue it's never a good idea. Even a place with, you know, a low violent crime rate or a low property crime rate still has individuals who are looking for those moments of opportunity. They might be prowling around just checking the doors to see if they open. So, yeah, you might be able to leave your car unlocked without anything happening most of the time, but not something that I would suggest. And frankly, again, it doesn't matter how high or low a crime rate might be. You're never guaranteed that you're not going to be the victim of a violent crime, right? We just saw this incident last week in a gated community in Southern California, where a group of armed home invaders targeted a family. So, listen, we all want to live in safe neighborhoods, but safe doesn't mean 100% crime free. Nancy McCraven lives a few doors down from where this took place as well. She says, why down there? Why that house? What were they looking for? She said, it's quite scary because usually we don't have anything going on here. Well, it may be that the suspects thought or knew that there was something inside of the home that they wanted to get. Again, police aren't saying much, but regardless, this also could have just been a crime of opportunity. And another reason why folks like Nancy and Justin and you and I need to take our safety seriously. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. I got nothing. I'm just going to read you the headline. Man says he ran over alligator to save neighbor trapped in his jaws. I mean, thanks. What else do you do when your neighbor's getting eaten by an alligator, right? This was in Collier County, Florida. Walter Rutter says he was driving into his neighborhood on Friday night, and he saw his friend and neighbor, Rick Fingerit, who was laying on the ground, screaming for help. And Walter says he then noticed an alligator about 11 feet long that had Fingerit by the leg and was dragging him into a pond at that point. He said, we pulled over. I got out of the car. I saw that the alligator had him by the leg. It was dragging him into the pond. Fingerit begged him to hit the alligator with his car, hoping it would release the jaws. So Rutter got back in his car, revved the engine, and it worked. He hit the gator, and the gator opened up its jaw. Fingerit was free, and scurried away while the alligator went into the pond. Rutter says it was an alarming incident, which, yeah, kind of an understatement. Fingerit is still recovering in the hospital. He says he doesn't know what would have happened had his neighbor not intervened. Says his two labs never left his side during the attacks, and he hopes to be released from the hospital soon. Trappers with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, captured the alligator, relocated the gator. They say that this is a reminder that alligator mating season is starting soon, which means the reptiles may become more aggressive and less fearful of humans. You know, I never thought I'd say this. Generally speaking, when I'm carrying, it's to protect myself against two-legged predators. But if you live in gator country in Florida, you're out for a walk, you might not be able to rely on your neighbor passing by in his car. So carrying a firearm for personal protection, not a bad idea. Not only during gator mating season, but year-round in the Sunshine State. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, I'm looking forward to being back with you again tomorrow. But don't forget to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day, where we're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member as well. All you have to do, go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code SAVEAMERICA, and you can get a significant savings on your VIP or VIP Gold membership. We're going to give you exclusive content you won't find anywhere else. It's our way of saying thanks for showing your support, because your support really does matter. And it truly does make a difference in this day and age of big tech censorship. It is more important than ever that we have the support of viewers and readers like yourself. So thank you again. I'll be on Newsmax tonight in the 5 p.m. hour with Carl Higbee, but I'll see you back here tomorrow as well. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.